Mackenzie.
Lamar.
Your dreams are coming true. We are finally doing classic movie month.
It has only taken literally over a year, so we're here. We did it. So happy.
If you call it quits after this, like this was the only reason you started this podcast to do this month, and you're like, we're done. I'm going to be a little pissed, but...
You know, no comment. No comment.
Okay. Well, part of the reason, I want to clarify this. They asked, the Prime Cut guys asked me last week, are you anti-classic films? I am not. I've seen Citizen Kane. I've seen a few of the older films. I haven't seen the ones that we're doing this month, but... My hesitation was, I know a lot of our listeners only listen to the episodes where they've seen the film. And, right. You know, we see our viewership numbers and it's like, well, if I haven't seen a movie, that doesn't mean that everyone hasn't seen it. But I feel like I watch more movies than most of my friends. So if I haven't seen it, my worry was like, we might be alienating some viewers for 4 weeks or listeners who haven't seen these films. That's a fear of mine. And hopefully we'll get some new taste in their mouths. But until then... I didn't want to completely alienate everybody. So my cold open question is, what's your favorite Vin Diesel movie? Let's start there.
What a compliment to the classics.
Yeah.
What would be a classic Vin Diesel? I feel like we can't do any Fast and Furious because we just talked about this on Prime Cut.
But I think most last week, yeah.
I think most people would reference those. But you know, we need like a deep cut, like a triple X.
Okay.
Do you remember
I don't
that?
Know that's a deep
Did you
cut.
See
I feel
that?
Like that was a pretty popular. My brother, that was his
it?
Favorite
okay.
movie for a while. So.
Okay,
granted, he was
I don't
like 12,
know
so.
Where everyone landed on that. That was in my phase of like, I will watch literally anything. And if you go mm-hmm. back and rewatch that movie, it's pretty terrible. And so, yeah, I didn't know if anybody actually liked it, but that's good to know. That's a fun one. He's kind of extra in that. But
I don't know if I ever saw Triple X. Then they made the sequel with Ice Cube and he wasn't in it. And then I think they made a third one where Vin Diesel came back.
I think they did. No, I stopped at the first one because, again, it was already pretty bad. But, you know, if you're willing to see Vin Diesel to try to be kind of like a spy, but not car related, it's kind of his shtick. I don't know. It worked.
You want a Vin Diesel right. movie where he's not a mechanic.
Yeah, can we just have one? Like, I just want one where he's not a mechanic.
I feel like he has that. Early in his career, Vin Diesel had a trend of leaving franchises because he thought he was too big for it. So Triple X, Fast and the Furious. I'm sure there's a third example, but he wouldn't be in the second one. But then he'd come crawling back for the third
he'd
one.
Come
so.
Back.
Yeah.
What? So is your favorite Groot?
I think that's it's weird that I still don't think of that as a Vin Diesel film. I know he's, you know, in it.
Because it doesn't sound like him.
Yeah.
Like, so. It's very simple.
I think that's to say something he's in. Yeah, probably Guardians of the Galaxy. The first one's probably my favorite of the bunch. But also underrated piece of garbage fun to watch film is Knock Around Guys, which I think I've mentioned on the pod before. It was sort of
but
a mobster movie. Yeah, it's sort of a mobster movie, but it's him, Barry Pepper, Seth Green. You get to hear, oh God, what's
Seth
his name?
Green.
John Malkovich do a really bad Italian accent. It's so bad. But it's a dumb, fun watch, and he's one of the main four in that.
What a cast that you just dropped. Like, what a mix.
Because when
people.
I think mobster films, I think Seth Green and Barry Pepper. But
for sure. Yeah,
it's Barry Pepper with, like, jet black dyed hair to make him look more Italian.
God.
It's a fun watch, yeah.
All right. Well, I don't know if we're adding that to the list, but it's a hard maybe. Hard. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are kicking off a whole new month that I could not be more excited about. It is Classics Month. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. We're here. We're here.
We made it. You've been on this platform for a calendar year.
I don't even know how long I've been asking for this, but we did it. And we're starting off with a good one, which I want to give a very quick background on how we chose the films for this month. So your girl here was very excited, obviously, and it took me like 3 business days to compose a list of really comprehensive, I felt, classic films with like a reason for each one, you know, a good representation of actors, directors, release periods, kind of film noir, screwball comedy, like solid representation. I put little spiels next to each one and I sent the list to Lamar and I said, I have one non-negotiable, which we'll get to later in the month. And then I have another one I would really like to do, but the rest are up to you. 37 seconds later, this fucker responds to my text and goes, let's do this one, this one, this one, and this one. Y'all, I was so sad. I was like, the work that went into that. And he chose in 30 seconds. So we're starting with It Happened One Night because Lamar chose it.
Which first off is bullshit because it happens in like four nights. This movie is a lie to start. Well, like, here's the thing. I realized, first off, you sending me a list, detailed as it was, and I do respect the amount of effort that went into that, but it would be like if I sent you a horror movie list and I was like, well, this one is like a slasher genre and it's about this killer. And like, if I went into all these different subgenres mm-hmm. of horror and you didn't really want to do a horror month, you would just be like, well, let's just do the ones that I've heard of. That was, so again, the second half of it was, my thought was, if I haven't seen these movies, let me pick the ones that I've heard of. Cause like yeah. they've been on my queue anyway. I want to watch these films at some point in my life. And then also some of our listeners may have heard of these films too. I didn't want to do right. not even that they're obscure, but just the ones that I hadn't heard of yet because mm-hmm. I want the listeners to stay tuned.
Yeah. So all that to say we dragged Lamar here kicking and screaming is what it comes down to. But no, I think I agree with you. I agree with your logic. I was just slightly heartbroken. I wish you could have just lied to me and taken, I don't know, five more minutes to pick choices, but it was fine. The reasoning is logical. This is an excellent one to start with, actually. It's a classic for a number of reasons that we'll get into. And yeah, it is a little bit of a lie. It takes a little bit longer than they say, for sure. But before we get into all of that, we, of course, wanted to focus on some classic cocktails as well. So what are we drinking this week?
Yeah, I thought it was cool that we're doing some classic cocktails along with the films because I didn't realize how many drinks that I ordered in bars, you know, 2-3 years ago that I was paying good money for that I could very easily make at home. And I think a lot mm-hmm. of people don't realize how easy it is to make some of these things that you get at bars. So today we're starting things off with just a classic Cosmopolitan. So 2 ounces mm-hmm. of vodka, 1/2 ounce of orange liqueur. I prefer Cointreau. Some people use Grand Marnier. 0.75 mm-hmm. ounces of lime juice, 1/2 ounce of cranberry juice, and 0.25 ounces of simple syrup. So again, it's 5 ingredients. And I don't know where Cosmo's got the bad rap from, but they're delicious. They're strong. Good after work drink and quick to make.
Sex in the City ruined it for everybody.
Is that what it was?
That's what it was. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's a perfectly okay. lovely cocktail. And then they had to take it and ruin it with their antics. But fun fact, the other reason we chose a Cosmo for this one is that this story was originally published January 1st, 1933 in Cosmopolitan magazine.
And obviously we're not going to be giving these super crazy names that are themed to the movie because we're just doing classic cocktails. We're not going to take credit for inventing a recipe. So sorry at Craft World. He did give us the specs on this, but we're just going to call this a Cosmo. It's a classic Cosmopolitan.
I will also say he came up with them as well. Like as far as what was going to fit for the movie, mm-hmm. I gave him lots of spiels about the movies and he curated those for us. So thank you again. And it thank is you, Skylar. Delicious. So cheers.
Oh, cheers.
All right. Well, we're going to go through some of the basics, hopefully a little quicker than normal, largely because you guys
we say
don't
that
know.
Every week. You always
no,
say
I know. Like, I know. I always say that. First of all, I'm a liar. Okay. You're right.
And then I slow you down by distracting you like this.
Okay. You do. I was going to say this is a team fail, actually. But secondarily, I really do think we're going to go faster this time because most people don't know half of these people that we're going to talk about because it's been a hot minute since these films were out. So we'll see. TBD. But obviously, like we said, we're talking about It Happened One Night, which was released in 1934. It has very high ratings across the board. On IMDb, it's 8.1 out of 10. And on Rotten Tomatoes, it's 98% from critics, 93% from audiences. And I think that's a testament, again, to how long it has been well-reviewed, well-received, because it's, I mean, this could have gone down by now a million times with all these reviewers. I was actually looking at some of the Rotten Tomato reviews, and like some of them are from a couple years ago. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, people are still putting some comments and things like that, and it's still a very well received film on the whole.
Obviously, my first time watching it, this movie is 90 years old. So, yes, some things haven't aged well, but what are you going to fucking do? It's almost an entire century old. So, but I really enjoyed it. I'll say that right off the bat. I saw that this was credited as the first screwball comedy. Which the writing is really tight. It's still, I was laughing out loud. I'm not going to say it's a perfect watch 90 years later, but I really did enjoy it. And I'd highly recommend it if you just want a sort of light comedy. And it's about 90 minutes long. So I'll start with that. Watch it.
Okay. Just warmed my heart. I'm just so excited now. I'm just, I was worried that Lamar was going to have a bad time, y'all. And I'm just glad that he's not. All right. So the director here is Mr. Frank Capra, who you probably do know from things like It's a Wonderful Life, maybe Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, but most people know him for It's a Wonderful Life these days, which, fun fact, I hate, which is quite a contentious opinion. But it's universally beloved by everyone but me. And Writers here, to your point, is very well written. It is based off of a short story called The Night Bus, which was originally written by Samuel Hopkins Adams, like I said, originally posted in Cosmopolitan magazine. He did a ton of stuff. He was actually he's a really interesting guy. He was actually a muckraker journalist. He did investigative reporting. He wrote a bunch of fiction and nonfiction novels, as well as plays. And he's known for some other things that also were made into films, like The Harvey Girls and The Gorgeous Hussy and things like that. So he was really a
Hussy?
Yes, The Gorgeous Hussy.
Why hasn't that been remade in the 21st century?
I think it probably has. We probably renamed it into something else. But he was really a prolific writer.
The Gorgeous Hussy.
The Great Woman. But yeah, if you didn't know, muckraker journalists were badasses, and he was one of them. He was a very prolific writer, which is awesome. Oh, cool. And then Robert Riskin did the screenplay. So even though this was so well written, this was a great script, they did obviously have to adapt it. So the screenplay version was done by Robert Riskin, and he's done things like You Can't Take It With You as well, which is Frank Capra did that, and Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, but a lot of other stuff that most people just wouldn't recognize, to be honest. Major cast, obviously, Mr. Clark Gable, fondly known as the King of Hollywood. And
which confused the shit out of me in this, because they call him King as a reference to his real life nickname, but the other guy in the movie is actually named King. And I was very confused at first, because in the first 5 minutes, they're like, you're marrying King. And then we have a second scene where it's like, King, King. And I, oh, that's her husband. No, it's not. That was a little confusing at first.
It was a little confusing at first. Skylar said the same thing, actually, when I made him watch. He's like, wait, who's King? And I'm like, no, not that one. Yeah. So you're not alone. But he kind of hated that. And that's one of the things I like about Clark Gable. He's really humble guy on the whole, even though he was Hollywood leading man for decades. But he just said all the time he was referred to as a king, and he said it was bullshit. Basically, he was like, I'm just a normal person. I'm just a lucky guy from Ohio who had a lot of help, was in the right place at the right time. And he's an Oscar winning actor who obviously was prolific and well beloved, and was just still pretty humble guy, which I like about him. He plays Peter Warren, but he has been most well known for probably Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
That's going to be the one that most people know him for. He's also done a bunch of other great stuff as well, but that's going to be the one. He also did Mutiny on the Bounty. That was one that he was also nominated for an Oscar for. He didn't win, but he was nominated for that one as well.
I had read something, and can you confirm, was Clark Gable actually dyslexic? I read that he was, but it wasn't known until after his death, but he had had all this success despite that.
I think it's just not confirmed. I mean, there's a lot of stories about it, but I don't think there's any way to be sure. I mean,
I don't know the science of confirming somebody's dyslexia after their death. How does
that work? That's what I mean. Like, I don't, unless he was around to affirm for us, I don't know how we would know for sure. But yeah, I've seen that a few times, but I don't know how true it is. Okay. Yeah. Claudette Colbert plays Ellie Andrews. She's been in a number of things. She did So Proudly We Hail is one of her more well-known ones, but also Cleopatra, where she has like a famous nude scene. It's a big deal. The Lady Lies and For the Love of Mike, which she actually did with Frank Capra, and they hated that experience, which is, fun fact, why she didn't want to be on this movie. And they had to double her salary to get her to do it.
I had read that neither of the two main actors wanted to be in this film. Yeah, she wanted double the salary. apparently when they wrapped, she called a friend and said, I just finished making the worst motion picture I've ever made. Friggin' yeah. Clark Gable showed up and on the first day just basically said, let's get this over with.
Yeah.
Neither of them wanted to do this, which is crazy because then it like swept at the Oscars, right?
Yeah, digging into that fun fact. So none of them wanted to work together. Frank Capra is like a pretty nice, chill dude, but he had had poor experiences with multiple people related to this production. And so nobody was super excited. Clark Gable did not want to work with him because this was actually a punishment. So if you didn't know a lot about the studio system late 1940s, you're a salaried actor for a studio typically. So you are aligned with MGM, Columbia, Paramount, Warner Brothers, whatever. And you have a set salary. And if you're not working on a film, you're not cranking something out, they're paying you for no reason. So MGM was paying Clark Gable to not work at this time. They didn't have a movie ready for him. And he had just gone through some shit. He had an affair with Joan Crawford. He had also not taken a role that he was offered because he thought the part was bad. So basically he was being loaned to Columbia as punishment is the way he felt about it. And MGM was actually netting like $500 a week in the loan. So they were making money on sloughing him off. He was pissed off. He didn't like the role. He didn't want to work on it. And part of it was because the writing when they started was pretty bad, or they felt it was pretty bad, which Frank Capra agreed, and they did a rewrite like at the beginning of production. So it did get better, but no, nobody was excited and nobody wanted to be here. And she, Claudette Colbert, apparently complained every single day of shooting. And so everyone was pretty miserable for a film that came out pretty fucking great, to be honest. It was, yeah, it was kind of interesting.
Did you tell me that it was either the first or second film to sweep at the Oscars first. The first one to win all five major categories, basically. I don't think it was nominated outside of those five, but Claudette skipped the Oscars. She wasn't even going to go because she's like, there's no way I'm winning. And then she found out
she was going to lose to Bette Davis, which to be fair was like a common occurrence at this time. Like Bette Davis was the Meryl Streep of the day. Mm. You know what I mean? It was just like, you're going to lose if Bette Davis is a write-in, which she was. And yeah, none of them thought very highly of this film, funnily enough. So they just didn't think they were going to win. But yeah, it swept. Only two others have done it. Silence of the Lambs and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Uh-huh. So
you got that right off the top of your head. Well done.
You know, I'm a dork and a loser. so I do what I can. But yeah, so I think like for all their conflict in doing this film, Frank Capra said later too that he was also pleasantly surprised about how well this film came out. So it overall really won the hearts and minds of audiences, and almost by mistake, like it just nobody expected it to be great, but it turned out to be really fun. There are a few other actors in here. I'll just say them quick. They're just the ones we encounter the most, not the most well-known as actors, definitely of these two. Walter Connolly plays Alexander Andrews, who's done things like Lady for a Day, which is actually decently well-known, Nothing Sacred, but he was not a film actor for very long. He did like five films. It was kind of crazy. Roscoe Carnes plays Oscar Shapley, who is worth noting because the combination of Shapley's character and Clark Gable's character are inspiration for one Bugs Bunny. So it's worth calling him out. And he did His Girl Friday. He also did 20th Century, a couple other smaller roles. But yeah, his whole demeanor and his like rapid fire, the way that he spoke, and the combination of that with Clark Gable and the carrot thing that we'll get to and the What's Up Doc situation really inspired the character of Bugs Bunny later, which is, I think, super fun. I love Bugs Bunny.
I just like the Shapley character, honestly. We'll get more into it, but I thought he was pretty damn funny.
He is funny. He's funny. He's a lot, but he's funny. And it kind of to your point, it's like certain things are like are not great, but they're like they don't hold up great, but they're funny.
They're also necessary to the plot at times, so.
100%. Yeah. And then last one, Jameson Thomas, who plays King Wesley, which again, source of confusion, but also importance at some point here. He's the husband to be of Ellie. And we only see him a couple times. He's kind of a weasel.
Which like, can we talk? Okay, go. Sorry. Do his film history. Cause then I want to go into spoilers. Cause that's my first nitpick.
He does a lot of supporting kind of things. Nothing major, but he was in the Moonstone and Coronado. People probably know him for Coronado, for example. Moonstone came out the same year as this.
Okay. Can we throw down the spoiler gauntlet right off the bat?
Yeah, I mean, this is so old. Like, yeah. Okay. Turn around. Don't drown. It's spoiler time.
This is the oldest movie that we've ever given a spoiler warning for officially on the pod.
I know, so it really is.
Yeah. But my first nitpick, I said I really enjoyed this, but I think the one big complaint I have is what you said. King Wesley's in two scenes, but we're supposed to be convinced that he's this conniving guy, and we kind of hear about the dealings through her father, and yeah. he doesn't really want her to marry him. But I thought there should have been something. Either he needed to show more of that ugly side of himself, because for what we see on screen, he seems like a stand-up guy, but they needed to villainize him, I think, a little bit more to convince me that she needs to leave him. And then the only other thing I thought it was going to end up being that Peter, he's a newspaper man, you see, I thought he was going to have dirt on Wesley, because he continuously talks about him and what a shitty person he is. She's like, oh, you're marrying King Wesley. You just want him for his money and he wants you for your money and blah, blah, blah. I thought it was going to be that he knew something about Wesley that we don't, and that would get revealed, but it never does. So Wesley just didn't land as a villain, I guess.
I think it's just, well, there's a number of things. One, I think things like that are more subtle in this era, right? So like there are some cues about him just on film that tend to be closely associated during this period to villains, right? So like his hair, his suits, like everything being kind of dark, his sharp mustache, dark, like, and he does this little, he has this like angle that he's shot at, and he does this kind of like snake oily look is the way I think of it, like the snake oil salesman look. And all of that now, I think in retrospect, doesn't feel super obvious. But I think at that time, those were like cue bad guy kind of cue. You know what I'm saying? So like it was very clear to audiences probably then that this was not the classy guy of the bunch. But I agree. I think he doesn't get a ton of screen time. I do get vibes from him though. Like even when he's talking to the dad, you know, where he's like in the office, why haven't you gone and found her? If this is your wife that you care so much about and you want to save her, and even if it is to have her money, she needs to be alive, right? For you to have her money. Yeah. If she's at risk or lost or whatever, and you're trying to prove how much you love her and how entitled to this inheritance or whatever you might be, you would put in a little effort. And he's really not. He's just in there like the negotiating table, very nonchalant for a guy whose wife is supposedly missing. So I thought that alone was like very red flag to me.
I think that's fair that, yeah, maybe it's in the subtext of what he's not doing. But I was like, well, only one of the two guys in this is threatening to sock her on the nose, whether she deserves it or not. And it's not the bad guy. So I was like, that also, I know that it's, I feel like it's being played for laughs, but I don't know how true it is of the time. But the number of times she's told to shut up by Peter.
And that she does. Yeah. Not, I mean, she doesn't do it all the time, but she does shut up sometimes. But
just like the number of shut ups. And I know it's supposed to be it's this ritzy, spoiled girl who honestly doesn't behave that poorly. Like she's a little naive, but I feel like she's for the most part.
Bratty moments, but yeah, she's not. She's just a little extra. I think she's a little extra.
That's a good word for it. But I thought it was weird that our hero is the one who's saying and doing those things, whereas the villain, who I did write, I caught that he kind of looks like he's got the stash and he's got the same sort of build as Clark Gable. Mm-hmm. So I wrote down Darth Gable because he's kind of this alternate version of Clark. And I'm like, oh, he's evil because he's kind of like that guy, but he's different. We don't like him.
But he's darker and eviler. I like it. Darth Gable. Oh my God. That's amazing. Yeah. Can we just call him that? That's less confusing than King Wesley.
They're both kings. Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Well, okay. So at a very quick high level, we're going to, I think, just go through like some of our favorite things about this film. But on the whole, the story is essentially that a rogue reporter trailing a runaway heiress for a big story joins her on a bus heading from Florida to New York, and they end up stuck with each other when the bus leaves them behind at one of the stops along the way. And they're stuck with each other, I just want to clarify, because he chooses to stay and watch out for her, and he doesn't really need to. He could have completely written her off and made the bus and been fine, but I do certainly see where she's naive, but also where she does come off as very entitled. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole reason she misses the bus is because she's like, oh, they'll wait for me. I told the driver to wait for me. So he's obviously going to wait for me.
I didn't read it as her being spoiled. I read it more as naivety of she assumes that's how buses work. Like you just say, hey, don't leave without me.
I think it's a combo, right? Like it can read entitled. It can read naive. Like I think part of it, she's a little naive about the way the world works. But I think it's a little bit entitled because that's the way her world works, right? Like if she tells a driver to wait for her in her normal day-to-day life, right? Like he's obviously going to wait for her. And it's because she's very privileged and spoiled. And so she doesn't quite realize that. And it's funny because she talks multiple times about how she never gets her way and she never gets to do what she wants. But the way that she moves through all of these spaces is to get her way and like to throw a tantrum to get her way one way or the other. And I think that's where he's such a great foil for her because he's trying to like challenge her and hold up a mirror to her and tell her like, this is not the way the fucking world works, kid. And you're right. Like the way that he says some of this does not hold up. It's, you know, really problematic the way he threatens her and talks to her sometimes. But I think on the whole, he's just trying to be like, kid, like, this is how the world works. You need a re-education a little bit in how the world works, which personally I was here for.
Yeah, I think their dynamic is fun. And I think it's a story, again, 90 years old. You've seen this story since then a bunch of times of people being taken out of their elements. Hallmark makes 6 of these movies every year of like people being put into new elements and slowly getting outside their comfort zone. And I do like those moments of hers throughout this when she's waiting in line for the showers and kind of has that situation where she walks in on somebody, doesn't realize there's a line and she gets yelled at, but she smiles about it. Like she's enjoying this sort of like being down there with the riffraff where she's not used to. Mm-hmm. There's another, the hitchhiking scene. She goes all in on that as well, you know, showing a lot of skin for that time. So I thought those scenes were fun. I like the way that she sort of evolves throughout this.
Well, let's pause there. So that is one of the most famous scenes in maybe film history, but certainly this film. And it is a big moment where the hitchhiking scene is so funny. I love the whole scene, by the way. Like that's the big climactic moment of the scene, but I love their dialogue back and forth. Yeah. I love Clark Gable's character, like giving all the different demonstrations of how to hitchhike. And he's so confident. And she's like you said, she's kind of having a good time with it. She's like, okay, teach me. Like, I want to learn this. I want to know and yada, yada. And they're having their first like almost friendly moment, it feels like, and they're kind of bonding. And so I love that whole scene. And then of course it doesn't go well for him. This is a very dead road. And all of a sudden there's 10 cars in a row where he can't get a single one of them to pick him up, which is just comical in of itself, very screwball. But then she goes and gives it a try. She asks, you know, can I give it a try? And he's like, go for it. Thinks she's hilarious that she's going to get somebody to do it. And the first thing she does is kick up her skirt, stick her leg out, put that leg on full display. And it's such a fun moment because the car comes screeching to a halt, first of all. So it's incredible. Of course, it works her first time out.
And for those of you who are those perverts out there who are like, oh, now I want to watch this movie. If you've never seen, when we say kicked up her skirt, it's the 1930s. She goes just over the knee.
Leg.
She goes just over the top of the knee. She is not hiking it way up to the thigh.
No, and she really didn't want to do this. Claudette Colbert did not want to do this. She thought it was incredibly unladylike. She pushed back on it. They actually got a body double to come and do it for her. Then she didn't like that shot. She said, that's not my leg. I'll do it. And so that's how she ended up actually doing it. Fun and ironic because she did a nude scene actually in 2 other films most recently, this I think the same year or the year before, in Cleopatra. But she was like very weird about
maybe she's very sick. Maybe she has weird calves or something. And she's like, very insecure.
I thought her legs looked great. She's in stockings and heels. She looked, I mean, I would have screeched to a halt. I'm not even into girls. Like, I would have been like, you know what? I love the stockings.
She seems like she wants to party. Yeah.
She wants to hang out. Let's get in the car and go. Yeah.
Which, like, I want to call out the scene right after that, but really quick, right before that, the thing that caught me off guard wasn't the like skirt up past the knee. I was surprised when they're doing the piggyback thing over the water that he just smacks her on the ass. That I thought was more surprising for that time period than the leg thing.
It is and it isn't, and it's problematic as to why. I agree with you. I think it's it looks so weird to us now, especially, right? Like, it is very odd, and it is like you're touching your ass, and also this is the 30s. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
I think it lands so funny, though, because he's like, hey, can you just, like, hold this real quick? And he tells her to hold the suitcase, and then he slaps her ass, and she's, like, holding the suitcase, enabling yeah. him to slap her. I don't know why that just, like...
And it's also in reaction to just her talking about why it is... They're arguing about whether it's piggyback or not, and then he just, oh, right. I play piggyback with my father. Your dad doesn't know how to play piggyback. You're too rich. And she's like, yes, he does. And in response to that, it's like him
he giving her on the ass. Yeah,
just like, you need to be taught a lesson. You are rich.
But that's exactly... Okay. That's exactly it. It's a scolding. It's teaching her a lesson. And that's yeah. why it's actually not that weird. And again, problematic, doesn't hold up. It was pretty common in films at this time to bend a woman over your knee and spank her as a punishment, like a light scolding.
And I'm looking forward to classic film month. I think this is going to be a great month.
Yeah, for that reason, sure.
But that's like not the reason. After that, after the piggyback and after the hitchhiking
argument, to your point, is like hilarious and ridiculous. The piggyback argument,
it's fun. That was a fun scene. Like, I like their little yeah. misadventures. But I did write, literally the only shot in this that hasn't aged well over 90 years, again, is that obligatory, it's a black and white movie, we have to have the car driving with the screen behind them doing the fake footage. Like, that is the one time where I was reminded of how old this movie is. So, I mean, kudos to the director on this and the cinematographers and whatnot, because everything yeah. else in this looks great.
Well, he did have the camera on a crane, which was like, so they're moving so quickly throughout this movie, which is not necessarily typical at this time, because this is a little bit more action oriented for a rom-com, I would say. So yeah. he didn't have a stationary camera, he had a crane camera that moved with them, so it does hold up in that sense. But it's so funny you say that, because that scene stood out to me too, but in that I was like, hey, that's really not bad for back then. I was very like, this is pretty good little background they got going. But I thought it was so funny that this driver is just like aggressively singing at them the whole time, and they're so annoyed with him. And I was just like, this is the most relatable moment. Like, we would also be annoyed with this man if he's just singing every single thing that he says and he yeah. thinks it's totally normal.
And it's like, and come to think of it, we don't need a ride, like, actually. We're okay. We'll just walk.
Yeah, we'll walk. Like, yeah. I will walk in my horrible heels just to get away from you singing the whole time. But yeah, he was a funny character for sure.
Yeah, I wanted to touch base, since we're sort of jumping around here, the scenes where they're sharing a bedroom and sort of those conversations, because this is one where
Talk about scandal.
Yeah, a lot of these films from the 1930s, and we'll talk about this more next week with His Girl Friday, but a lot of them feel like they were adapted from stage plays, because they were, but they feel that style where yeah. you are setting on one location and even one camera shot in a lot of instances for, you know, 10 minutes at a time. And it's 10 minute scene after 10 minute scene. And they're having these long conversations that feels like you could be yeah. watching it on stage. And that's what these bedroom scenes feel like, where they're having these long drawn out. It's just the two of them. And again, I really like sort of the way that they flirt with each other, but they're kind of mean to each mm-hmm. other, and they have these heart to hearts, but then they're being super critical. Mm-hmm. And it's these very honest conversations. I dug that.
I love their interactions when they're kind of paused, to your point. Like, I mean, the dialogue throughout is so good. I just think, like, and this is, and I told you this before we ever started this month, like, I just think that Hollywood writing at this time was so much stronger, because mm-hmm. you just weren't reliant on all the antics, right? And you had to have better source material, and the source material is really good. They're all of their interactions are really good, but I agree with you, like, kind of when they pause and have a moment a little bit longer together is always a really, that's where they're getting to know each other, and where you start to see them bond a little bit more and be a little bit more vulnerable with each other. Her especially being very, like, you know, commenting on the things that she doesn't know, or that she's learning, or that she finds interesting, or what's been different about her life to this, or what have you. And I love those interactions. That's what made this movie in a lot of ways really scandalous, admittedly, for the time. You know, they had the quote Wall of Jericho, which I think is like a funny bit for the whole movie. I think it lands so well, the just blanket wall.
For the record, though, sharing a bedroom with two separate beds in the 1930s, that's basically third base, just so you guys know out there. I did some reading on that.
To translate, yes, exactly. It's pretty gnarly. And they are pretending to be married, and that's like part of the shtick, and mm-hmm. that's the only way they can get a room together, right? Like, they're, people just won't let a room to you if you're not with your spouse. But there are so many little scandalous things, like she undresses and throws the lingerie over the wall of Jericho, and he's like, I wish you would take that down.
It's hot and bothered.
Yep. It's, I'm getting hot and bothered, you know, it's pretty spicy. But also him like just undressing in front of her and like really committing to the bit and being like, you know, pressuring her basically to go on the other side of the wall. Like, I'm going to keep undressing until you go away.
He does like his little striptease. But I didn't like that he said he takes off his pants before his shoes. That doesn't make sense.
He said other people take off their pants before their shoes. That's what, like what his narration is. You know, most people next would go for the pants, but I go for the shoes. And I'm like, who goes for the pants before the shoes, you crazy person?
Unless he was just improvising or trying to make a joke about it, of like, well, I'm going to take my pants off.
It's funny you say that, because that scene is pretty well improvised, but mm-hmm. he actually had issues with it, which it caused again much scandal that he didn't have an undershirt on. And this was because he was trying to do his whole monologue while he was undressing, and it was like too much for him to coordinate and try to get the undershirt off. So he just did it without the undershirt, and that led to, supposedly, the lore is that it was an ongoing trend of people not wearing undershirts after this, which was pretty scandalous and pretty uncommon, to the degree that people like stopped buying them. And it was all like credited to Clark Gable, you know, just bare chested, which like, he looked great. So
they should have had him drop his pants and showed us what underwear. Maybe he was wearing a thong or something. He could have started another trend. Like, Fruit of the Loom could have made up that money elsewhere. Just saying.
I was going to say, they did try to sue Columbia, the underwear industry, but that's, you know, that's another story.
I did a little bit of reading on that, on like, is it Snopes, the website that like disproves all the urban legends and stuff. And they're like, it's unclear, because it's not like it's have metrics from the 1930s of how well undershirts were selling, but it's a fun little urban legend to think about.
I also just think it's cool that it's just because he was annoyed at undressing with the undershirt, and then all of a sudden potentially had this huge impact, because it's Clark Gable, right? Like, it makes sense, but it's just crazy that something so nuanced and just producing a movie can lead to that potentially. So I thought it was very cool. And it's their cute dynamic of like, she wants to go to the line, really. She's like kind of naive, but she is testing the water. She is testing the edge. She doesn't want to move away while he's getting dressed, because she wants to prove that like, she doesn't care. She's unruffled by this. And then he goes for the pants, and she's like, shit, you know, she like, just kidding. I can't, and like run to the other side of the wall. And so you kind of learn a little bit about her too. Like, she's a little bit of a rebel. She wants to like jump in with both feet in all these weird areas that are scary and new for her. But she does have a line, you know, and that was one of them. But they have some of their best interactions in that room, for sure.
I was going to say, the two that stand out to me, I like that conversation where they're just getting cut. He doesn't actually tell her his name until like 40 minutes into the movie. Like, they've been on adventures for a while now, and then she finally gets his full name. And I love that delivery of, it's Peter Warren. She says, I don't like it. Like, he doesn't like his name after all that build up.
I just don't
like your name. And then eventually they say, good night, Mrs. Warren. Good night, Mr. Warren. And I like that they embrace the ruse, because then I think the next day is when the detectives show up, and they have to sort of play it up. And I loved that too.
That fucking scene is just chef's kiss. Mm-hmm. I just, if you just snip that one scene out of this movie, you know why it's so good, because they just on a dime flip into this improv. And again, this is a naive young woman who hasn't really been in this context that she then plays for the detectives. And this guy doesn't know her well and all of that. And they just lean into this really kind of problematic, like potential domestic violence relationship situation, that then of course these cops are like, ooh, you know what? That's a family affair. We would like to exit stage left. And that's essentially what happens. And so it's like, for modern day eyes and ears, you're like, ooh, that's a little problematic and probably not great. But they fucking commit, and they're so good. Their back and forth is so, so good. I love that whole scene.
It's like
all the
classic
dialogue.
Misdirect of the detectives are trying to interrogate them, and instead they're doing this entire diversionary tactic of not answering the questions, just having a very public argument, and him continuously yelling, like, quit balling, like, at her.
I know.
Just completely ignoring the detectives. I had written down, how do they not recognize her? But that gets explained away next scene when they say, oh, we should get photos out to all these detectives right. looking for my daughter. So I was like, okay, yeah. that even the little plot hole I found is explained away next scene.
Yeah, they do a pretty good job of capturing those. And I just like also, so they have the scene, they are about to leave and the hotel guy is like, I told you they were a perfectly nice married couple. And I think that's just like the funniest response to what just happened. They leave then the door, like give it a beat, you know, it's been 30 seconds. They're laughing. They're bonding over how well they just did. And then somebody else knocks on the door and they just snap right back into it. Yep. That to me is like the other cherry on top. It's so good. I love how ready they are to just roll with it.
The ruses in this are two of the best scenes. I think that one. And then when I think my favorite Shapley scene is when he's talking to him in the woods after the bus crashes and he's playing it all like Shapley is basically saying, I know who she is. I know you're trying to get her, but there's a $10,000 reward. Let's split it. And he plays it off. Peter plays it off as he's part of the mob and they basically kidnapped her. And just the way that escalates is such a just watching a con man at work is incredible.
It's such a slow burn too. Like it's a night, like it starts one way and you're like, ooh, what's he doing? And then it like goes a little bit, ups the ante a little bit. It just gets better and better. Like the whole scene just gets better and better to where he's then running into the woods in the dark and falling all over himself. And yeah, just seeing the con man at work and he's so smooth and he's not really like a con man. Obviously we've established he's a newspaper man, which is such a sexy, job at this time. Right. So he's just so smooth and all of these things, but he leans in again to the improv here and he gets this guy to just like run away from them. But
the cherry on top of that is when he finally has the situation solved and Shapley's running off into the woods to God knows where, but he's out of view. And he tries to do like a badass little spit like a mobster and it like lands on his jacket. Like that is just cherry on top.
And on his chin.
Yeah.
And on his chin. And the chin bit really bothers me because he doesn't fix that. He just fixed the jacket. And I'm like, okay. But yes, it's so, again, it's just so funny. It is that, again, like screwball comedy vibes that I think that are great. And then you get to this like, the scene with the bus driver and that whole, like, you get these kind of wholesome moments of them bonding on the bus, but then they have to get off. Like, this mob situation, so to speak, has driven them off the bus so that they can still, you know, they're like, he's going to come to his senses and he's going to realize that this was some nonsense. We still got to get off the bus and get away from everyone.
I was wondering why they never brought back bus ride karaoke, like team karaoke on the bus. And then the bus crashed and I understood why.
And you were like, this is why, because the driver can't stay straight. Like, let's talk about that driver for a second. What a terrible driver. Just immediately is like... Lasts for 2 seconds, crashes the whole bus.
Yeah. And you also and I love get
that he's annoyed with them. He's like, yeah, you can walk. It's 10 miles away. And I'm like, bitch, you crashed the bus. Anyway,
You also get a little cameo by the director there. So Frank Capra is the third singer. The wise, like, oh, do you mind if I do the third verse? And so I thought that was a little fun. He's like the original, I don't know, Stanley, Quentin Tarantino, something like that.
And he does a lovely voice. We'll give him that as well. He does a good job.
Yeah.
I do like that they then go to like the hay scene because it's like there's, you know, it's kind of a classic, like we're going to just, you know, hunker down from the night in a barn and, you know, get you like puffed up in some hay. And she like lays down and, you know, she's so annoyed and she's hungry. And she's like, they have this whole debate about like tired versus hungry and all of this and or scared versus hungry rather. And she lays down and then she's like trying to be Mrs. Tough Guy and be like, I don't really care. You can leave. Yeah, like, I'd be whatever.
Fine.
Yep. I'd be totally fine. And she's not looking and whatever. And then once she realizes he's not there, she goes into a full blown fucking panic and he comes back with carrots for her and she's falling all over him, excited that he's here and all of that. And I just love that one, he didn't hear the benefit of any of her shit talking about how she would be fine without him. And all he gets is her just glee to see him practically.
Yeah, you think he's like teaching her a lesson and maybe listening in the wings, but that's not what's happening. He's literally just out picking carrots.
He's getting her carrots and she turns them down. Like, I love that she was like willing to starve at the beginning of this rather than eat carrots. She's like, I'm not gonna
my guess would be that scene is the one that got her the Oscar, where she's sort of monologuing to herself and going through all these emotions of being strong, doubting that, being terrified, and then just falling into his arms, you know?
That and later, like in the room where they have to share that room and she's like realizing her feelings for him and they soft focus her and the whole, you know, you can see that filter real hard. And then she gets all glistening eyed. Like it's so well shot. I love those close ups, especially back then. It was just like these beautiful kind of well lit glassy close ups. And she's just basically realizing that she's in love with him. I think those two scenes are like her strongest scenes.
You get that shot, the must-have shot where, oh, are they going to kiss, where he's laying her down, he covers her up with his jacket, and then you get that short. And I thought that at the end of this, of like, they never actually kiss. We get hinted at the end of what's going on with the walls of Jericho, you know, that little metaphor there. But the leads never kiss, which is kind of interesting for a rom-com.
Yeah, I mean, they don't, and I think it's intentional, because you get those almost, like you said, there's a couple of almost moments, and they have these other intimate moments that aren't really about that. You know, it's like the room is very intimate, the breakfast is intimate, the hay thing, and not just laying her down, obviously, but like the whole scene of him getting her food and setting up this bed for her, like all these other small intimacies that I think are really cute. The one that made me laugh the most, though, is the next morning when she has hay in her teeth. And she lets him pick the hay from her mouth with his penknife. And I was like, number one,
what the hell kind of dreams were you having?
Number one, I was like, this would be me picking at my teeth.
Oh my God, Mackenzie.
But number two, I just was like, what a romantic moment of like, this guy's getting the hay out of my teeth with a knife. I just thought it was so funny. It was like the rom-coms of the 30s, a very different bar for romance. That's all I'm saying.
You're picking not really hay in love if you've never picked hay out of each other's teeth.
Right. Like, is it even real? Is it even real, honestly?
I will say, when we get to them professing their feelings, the I love you rings a bit hollow, because to that point, they're bickering and whatnot, but it doesn't feel as though it's becoming a super romantic thing until a few minutes before, like the one scene before that. And then it becomes, oh, I love you. And I get it's 1930s. Like, that's what people want to see on the screen. It's that part rings a little bit hollow, but I do like that he just tells her, go back to bed. That's the way he plays it off.
Well, I think that's supposed to be him like being a classy guy, right? At this point, like he probably could have handled that differently and different things could have happened. But he's being the classy fella in saying like, no, you need to go back to bed. Like, and this is, and he also, I think to some degree has a little bit of insecurity, which we see a little bit later as well of, I can't really provide for this person in the way that she is accustomed because I have a dollar to my name, right? And like, she gave this money away, right? So I can't really take care of her. And so I think there's like a lot swirling in his brain with some of that. And he definitely is, you see him getting, you know, starting to kind of think she's sweet, not be as annoyed by her. He calls her a million terrible names throughout that are so annoying, but also kind of funny. The one that stands out to me the most, my mom called me this all the time when I was a kid. And I was like, this is what this is from. The smart aleck comment.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the smart aleck all the time. Like I cannot tell you how many times I've been called a smart aleck in my
life.
That's
a pretty, I think that's a pretty fairly, I remember teachers saying that, but so like, was that didn't originate in this film though, right? It's just slang from that era.
I think it was like from that era, but this is like one of the most popularized references me either. Because again, like when I'm a kid, you know, I'm hearing that all the time, but it just made me laugh so hard. I was like, you know, they call each other, and she does it to him too. Like they call each other these names back and forth. But I do think you see these kind of like subtle moments, like I said, of them becoming friendly and bonding and all of that. But I agree. I think it is a very like 30s rom-com to all of a sudden sort of flip the script. And it's like, just kidding. We're like, actually, we're not just friends. We're not just friendly, but like we're in love.
And I think it also ties back to what I said about King Wesley. If they had had him villainized in some capacity where he did something to show her that he's not a good guy, I guess then we wouldn't get her leaving him at the altar. I mean, you could still get her leaving him at the altar, but also first movie to do that ever, which is kind of bonkers to think about. Again, something you've seen a million times since then, but first movie to have a bride leave the husband at the altar. But I feel like he should have done something to push her toward Peter a little more. I think that would have helped the love story a little more in my eyes.
I think Peter does it on his own to some degree, though. Like, he gets the part, speaking of Oscars, right, and like why people win and why this was so well done. I think if you were to pinpoint a moment for Clark Gable's character, for example, it's that monologue in the bed where he's telling her about true love, right? Mm-hmm. Like, somebody real, somebody who's alive, who wanted, you know, go into this island in the Pacific with me and like get into the ocean and enjoy it as much as I do. And like the whole way that he describes that is, again, it's like back to the writing. Like, the writing is beautiful. It's very poetic. And it's this moment of vulnerability for him that you also see her really just like, I mean, she's falling in love with him as he's saying it, right? So I do think there's these moments of these lead-ins to he's actually romantic, he's actually sweet, he does care about love, and you know, there is somebody here who could potentially be that person for him. So I think it's more about like, what did she see in him that she didn't realize that she was missing? You know what I mean? It does feel from the very beginning that whether King Wesley is good or bad, it was never about him. It was about this rebellion against her father and being able to like just do what she wants to do when she wants to do it. And it feels very, very much at the beginning, it feels like it's just about her being rebelling against the control that she feels like she's had for so long.
And I like the incorporation of the father and his role throughout it. I didn't like him at the beginning, but as it goes on and you realize he just wants the best for his daughter. And then he does a couple 180s of telling her, like, you know, don't marry him. If you have feelings for this other guy, just don't marry it. Like, he doesn't want, and then he wants her to marry him and then he doesn't. But I like his incorporation and how it sort of factors into the climax where they sort of have this miscommunication. He disappears in the middle of the night to go and basically set up plans for them to run away together. But by the time he gets that done, she's been kicked out of the hotel. She thinks he abandoned her. Then he gets back and thinks she abandoned him. And it's just, again, miscommunication. But I like the way that plays out in their little arguments and seeing each other the day of the wedding. That entire last 20 minutes is pretty solid.
Yeah, I think it gives you like a slow burn, because it could be something that just fixes itself very quickly, right? Like, he could just go find her and say, like, what happened? What do you mean? You know, and they don't, because they both feel hurt by something that the other did. But then they don't really forget about each other, you know, and you see this this moment with Peter and his editor where he's like giving the money back. And again, you're seeing him be honorable in all these little ways over and over again. So it's, you know, you're affirming that he's a good guy. And he feels bad for him. He can see that something has changed in him. He offers him his job back, you know, literally out of pity, right? And so you see that they're both just really hurting after this. So it makes that kind of quick love story, I think, like, feels like it was really quick for a minute there. It lends it some more credibility, right? Yeah. The fact that they're pining for each other and they miss each other, and it feels more genuine at that point, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I really like how this wraps up. I kind of enjoy the fact that we don't see them kiss. We just get to assume that they're having sex. So that's awesome.
It's been a long road. Get you some, guys. Like, have a great time. But no,
and
I
like
agree.
The trumpet callback, I think, is fun. I think the humor in this, more of it landed than I expected to. And I'm a big fan of callbacks in screenplays. Yeah. And so the trumpet callback, the Walls of Jericho falling, the oh yeah callback when she goes to hold the bus for me. Oh yeah. And that getting mentioned 3 or 4 times. Make it collect, where he charges his boss for the phone call.
Like, oh just my God, the I love back it. Charge. And the telegrams. Like, I just... Yeah. So many little just comedy gems. And I think one of my favorite, just to your point, the way that it wraps up, what I love is, like, who knew they were going to introduce role playing in the 30s, right? Like, just we're exiting on, like, there's some stuff going down in that room. And I think they might be the first people role playing on screen, to be honest.
We're breaking all kind of barriers here today.
Okay, well, all that to say, like, it's such a great film. It's so funny. I think it wraps up with a beautiful, beautiful bow. What is your rating, though?
Yeah, so, I mean, taking into account that this is a 90-year-old picture, which I think I've said 100 times today. I think I've said that almost 90 times, maybe.
Every year that it was here, yeah.
Yeah. So taking that into account and just knowing how original, we've talked about how groundbreaking it was and how so much of the script is still really tight. If you're one of those people that only watches classic films for Christmas time, and that's like the only time you watch a black and white picture, like, I highly recommend this. It's an enjoyable comedy. So it's not perfect. There's a few things that don't land, a couple things that haven't aged well that you're going to kind of cringe at a little bit. But I give it like 8.5. Like, I thought it was pretty damn good. I really enjoyed it.
Oh my God, I'm so happy. Y'all, I wanted him to have, like half of my movie selection was I tried to pick ones I thought you would like. That was part of why it took so long. So I'm glad that you liked it. I'm so glad you had a good time. I would agree. I'm like a solid 8.5, maybe a 9. I think the reason it's probably more of an 8.5 these days is just to your point. Like, we have to acknowledge the things that don't land super great anymore, but of its time, it was an awesome film, and it's, there's a reason that it swept the Oscars, because everything really came together for the group of people that didn't want to work together. Did it put out a great piece of work? Amazingly enough,
it's also fun to just see, and we've mentioned 5 or 6 of them, but just how much of this did it first, and now there's all these tropes that at this point weren't tropes yet. So it is very cool to see those come out. Yeah. Also, this was number 3. On the American Film Institute's top 10 romantic comedies. So I assume number 2 is Just Friends with Ryan Reynolds. And number 1's maybe Failure to Launch, that Terry Bradshaw and whoever movie. I don't know.
How did you know? I'm sure that's that's a very accurate listing. I would agree with you. I think it's a great one. And I mean, like I said, I think it makes sense that it swept the Oscars, and like they won for what they won, and there's actually all kinds of great stories about the Oscars. Before I forget, the Clark Gable actually gave away his Oscar for this. If you didn't know, he gave it to a young boy who had like congratulated and fanned on him over his Oscar, and he said that winning it and the achievement was more important than owning it, and he gave him the Oscar. And fun fact, that boy returned it to Gable's family after he died. And Steven Spielberg, who we spent all of November talking about, purchased it at auction and actually donated it back to the Motion Picture Academy so that they could keep it. But yeah, it's had quite a life, his little Oscar.
The more we can refer back to Novemberg, the better, because it gives me a reason to say that name. But yeah, that's a cool little story. I wasn't aware of all of that. I didn't know all you had to do was ask an actor for their Oscar. And the moment was more than
enough.
You know
who won't give you their Oscar if you ask? Leonardo DiCaprio. It took him too long to get it. He's never going to hand it over to you. He's going to be like a hard no 100% of the time.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I wanted to say before we wrap, Mackenzie, is I'm happy to be doing Classic Movie Month, which is good that I can kind of get outside my comfort zone a little bit, because I do come from a long line of stubborn idiots. I liked that line of dialogue a lot.
I fucking love that line. There's so many great ones. So many great ones. I appreciate you closing us out on a high note, because that's a good one. Well, thank you for joining, fam. I am so glad we're doing this. So come back next week where we continue the fun with one of my personal favorites. Not quite Deal Breaker, but it was close. His Girl Friday, which we talked about for a hot second today as well. Great film. Watch it beforehand if you get the chance. And don't forget, in the meantime,
follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things, mostly on Instagram, TikTok. You can also email us at wedrinkandwewatchthingspod@gmail.com. Any questions, suggestions, things you want to hear in 2025. But yeah, make sure to give us a subscribe, follow, all that good stuff. We're on YouTube now if you want to watch the video portion. That's like the new thing. So yeah, anything helps us to get more ears on the product.
Spotify has video as well if you want to check it out. So please give us a watch or a listen, whatever you prefer. But for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.